The Faces of Contemporary Islam, Fresh Perspectives on Theory, Practice, and Foreign Policy, a Women's Foreign Policy Group conference in Washington, D.C., featuring Carnegie Scholars. This November 18, 2008 podcast is a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. His Excellency, Dr. Hussein Hassouna, Ambassador of the League of Arab States to the U.S., gives the following keynote address, The U.S. and the Muslim World. Judy Woodruff, a senior correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, moderates and interviews the ambassador following his address. Patricia Ellis, the president of the Women's Foreign Policy Group, opens the luncheon.
I'm Patricia Ellis. I'm president of the Women's Foreign Policy Group. And on behalf of our entire organization, we have a number of board members here. Diana Negroponte, Donna Constantinople, Susan Rappaport, and Gail Kitch, who just stepped out. We really want to welcome all of you. Thank you so much for your participation, and just we're so pleased that you could all join us for this very special conference. It really has been an amazing morning. I also want to once again thank Carnegie, Patricia Rosenfield, Hillary Wiesner, who just stepped out, for their enormous support. I mean, it's just been a great joint project and such a pleasure working with them and working with the scholars. And I just want to say this came out of, we're doing individual programs with the scholars, and they were also wonderful, and I just got the idea that they really have so much interest in common, and they should be talking to each other, and so that's how we developed the concept of the conference. And I mean, they just exceeded everybody's expectations, because all the presentations were wonderful and the discussion so rich and lots of good questions. So I just want to say that. We also are very pleased to be joined by a number of ambassadors and diplomats. We have the ambassador, our speaker, the ambassador of the Arab League. We have the ambassador of Croatia, deputy chief of mission from Lebanon, and if other representative of the British Embassy. Now, I have not talked to everyone, so I think all the diplomats should stand, and let's just give them a warm welcome. Thank you. We work very closely with the diplomatic community, and it's really fantastic. And before I go any further, I just wanted to thank the staff, Kim, Sarah, and all the interns and volunteers. We would not be here without them. Let's give them a big round of applause. So now this is another important part of the conference, and we're so fortunate today to have as our luncheon speaker Ambassador Hussein Hassouna, and he's the Arab League ambassador to the U.S. He's going to speak about the U.S. and the Muslim world. And we're extremely fortunate to have my good friend and former colleague Judy Woodruff with us. She is a very busy woman, particularly coming off the election season, and it's just really special and means so much to the Women's Foreign Policy Group and also to Carnegie, where she was a board member, that she could join us today. She's now senior correspondent and the political editor in 2008 of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. So, without further ado, I want to turn the podium over to Judy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pat, very much. I'm just thrilled to be here, and I just want to say, first of all, how thrilled I am to be anywhere after this never-ending election that finally did end. And yet, yes, we're excited that it's over, but what an interesting time. we are in right now as this transition gets underway, as we watch the drama, or I guess no drama, of the change from one administration to another. It's such an interesting time to be here in the nation's capital. The only place that may be a little more electric is Chicago. I was there yesterday, and I can report to you that the excitement level is up to here. Of course, they all plan to come to Washington, either to visit on January the 20th for inauguration or to stay. It's an exciting time across the country, and especially in these two cities that we like so much. And I'm so pleased to be here working with the Women's Foreign Policy Group and with my dear friend and former colleague, as she said, Pat Ellis. I want to say a word of congratulations to Pat, because you've done such an extraordinary job with this group over the years. So let's give Pat a hand for the great work you've done. It is also very special, as Pat mentioned, for me to be involved with this exciting initiative that has been promoted by the Carnegie Corporation of New York on promoting better understanding of Islam. I'm so pleased that Pat and Hillary are here. You've heard their names. You've seen them as part of the program this morning. I did, as Pat said, serve on the Carnegie Corporation board for 6 years, so I know firsthand the genuine commitment that Carnegie and its leaders at the very top, Vartan Gregorian, have to increasing understanding of the diversity of thought and culture and history in Islam and Muslim societies and Muslim states around the world, and certainly the U.S. engagement with these societies and with these states. And it is now my privilege and my pleasure to introduce to you today's speaker. He is Dr. Hussein Hassouna. He's a native of Egypt. He has had a distinguished career in diplomacy and in international law. He has served as the ambassador of the League of Arab States to the United States since July 2002. He previously served as ambassador of the League of Arab States to the United Nations and assistant minister of foreign affairs of Egypt for international legal affairs and treaties. He's also served as ambassador of Egypt to Morocco and to Yugoslavia, served as director of the cabinet to the deputy prime minister and the minister of foreign affairs of Egypt, and as director of the Egyptian Press and Information Bureau in Paris. He has also served on Egyptian delegations to Middle East peace negotiations, leading to the signing of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. So please join me in welcoming Ambassador Hassouna, who will discuss the U.S. and the Muslim world. And after we hear from him, he and I will have a conversation for about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to questions from all of you. So please join me in welcoming Ambassador Hassouna.
Good afternoon, everyone. When I was first approached by the ambassador of Yemen, my good friend Abdul Wahab al-Hijri, who I believe is a member of your group, suggesting that I should be a speaker at the conference, I said, why me? I mean, there are so many prominent women ambassadors of the Muslim world in Washington. They can much better represent the Muslim world. He said, no, they want you. So I've been in touch with your president, Patricia Ellis, and she insisted that I should come and talk to you. So here I am. You have no bias or discrimination, neither have I. I think the topic of this conference and the topic of my talk on U.S. Muslim relations is of critical importance today. It is of importance because we all live in the United States or in the Western world, and many of us belong to the Muslim world, and we see this lack of understanding between the United States and the Muslim world in general. We see that Muslims are sometimes stereotyped. There is a misinterpretation representation, misinterpretation of even the holy text of the Quran. Muslims sometimes have been profiled, and I would say sometimes even demonized in this society and in the Western society. Sometimes I think this is out of ignorance, and sometimes it's out of hate. So I think this takes place, I will talk a little bit how I see the reasons for that, but this takes place in spite of the fact that the Muslim people represent 1.3 billion people in this world. In spite of the fact that there are 57 independent Muslim states belonging to the Organization of Islamic Conference. In spite of the fact that the Muslim civilization was a great civilization that was a very enriching factor in the Western civilization. In spite of the fact also that the Muslim religion is the fastest growing religion in this country and in many others, in that it beats sometimes the Mormons. But what is the key to understanding the Muslim world? I think this is the beginning. People in the United States and in the West have to understand that the Muslim world is a mosaic, is a diversity of people. It's not, they might have some common affinities, they are linked by a Muslim identity, by their faith, but otherwise they are very different. They have different institutions, different history. They are Arabs and Muslims, and they're not alike. Not all Arabs are Muslims. Many Arabs are Christians and Jews. And not all Muslims are Arabs. The largest Muslim country is not an Arab country, it's Indonesia. Iran is not an Arab country. And I find many Americans who think that Iran is an Arab country belonging to the Arab League. It is not. So I think to understand what's this diversity, one has also to understand the ongoing clash that exists today, unfortunately, in the Muslim world, between conservatives and between modernists, between different sects. And I think that one sad feature also is that many of these differences in religion or in sectarianism are exploited by politicians for political purposes. I know this very well. I know it from my experience in Iraq, for instance, today. I also lived in Yugoslavia. We have the ambassador of Croatia there. And this was also the case that very often these differences in religion were exploited by politicians for their own political agenda. And this is the difficulty in finding sometimes solutions to these problems, because when politicians use religion, it is a very emotional issue, and it can really divide people. So my advice to the United States is not to exploit these differences, is to be a unifying power, and not sometimes back one side against the other, which it has happened. What is the role of the United States today vis-a-vis the Muslim world? The United States has always been an open society, a tolerant society, a melting pot of all different backgrounds. And this was the greatness of the United States. I always said, I lived in Europe many years. I lived in France and in Britain and so on. But I always said the United States is the only country in the world where no one feels a stranger, because they all come from different backgrounds. The United States was also perceived in the Muslim world as the country that is always supporting freedom, self-determination, the famous Wilson principles, the country that was the peacemaker between Egypt and Israel, between Jordan and Israel, and so on, and are still involved now in finding a solution to the Palestinian problem. So people looked at the United States as different from the colonial powers that were Britain and France and Italy, for instance, in our part of the region in the Middle East. But what happened? September 11 had a devastating effect on the relationship between the United States and the Muslim world. It raised a series of questions and notions. First of all, Americans started to ask, why do the Muslims hate us? Well, the answer is that the Muslims love America. They respect America, their lifestyle, their education, their democracy. The only problem which they don't agree with and which they question very often is the policies of the United States, the fairness of their policies. Secondly, September 11 unleashed a notion that there is a clash between our two cultures, our two religions, the Muslim religion and the Christian and the Jewish religion, that there is a clash between the Muslim civilization and the Western civilization. Does this exist? It doesn't. It's wrong again. What does exist is that there is a clash between the extremists on both sides. But the mainstream in the Muslim world, in the United States and the Western world, are people who want to coexist, to live together. They're moderate people. And Islam is calling for moderation. Islam is a religion that accepts and recognizes Christianity and Judaism. And it calls for people to live together. The people who are not Muslims in Islam, the true Islam, are called the people of the book. They have their own holy books, and they are respected by the Muslims. This is what Islam stands for. So another unfortunate feature of this September 11 is that in the United States and in the West, sometimes there was a tendency to generalize among Muslims, that there was no focus on the guilty ones. There was no focus on the terrorists who attacked not only the United States in September 11, but attacked also the Muslim societies, and they're still doing it. And there is no way to confront them but to work together and defeat them. But there is a tendency to talk about Muslim terrorism, about the culture of the Muslims that generates violence. And this is a very unfortunate factor, because it is a way of accusing the Muslim world in a way as almost as a collective guilt, that these people are collectively responsible for what's happening, and they are not. So these are the notions, I think, that emerged from September 11, and it is very unfortunate. But if something good came out of September 11, in my view, it is that it was a wake-up call. It was an occasion for people to try to understand better what Islam is, what the root causes are of this crisis, and how we can overcome this and work together and promote a better understanding between the Western world and the Muslim world. I think that we are now, of course, facing a new administration, and this is the subject which we are all discussing. Washington is full of rumors, analysis, expectations. I think that it is a new beginning, maybe, in our relation. It doesn't mean that all these expectations will be fulfilled, in my view. I also think that it might be an occasion, maybe, to try to bring about a change in U.S. policies. And what does the Western world expect from the new administration? First of all, I think the Muslim world expects the new administration to engage more the Western world, to try to listen more to their concerns and their aspiration, to try to help them more, especially in these difficult times when the Muslim world, that is mainly representing the developing world today, are facing huge problems. Food prices are rocketing. The financial crisis is affecting everyone. And the Muslim world has no means of bailout like the United States and the rich Western world. So I think they need attention and they need help from the United States. I also think that one thing which the new administration should do is to get involved into the difficult problems facing the Muslim world. And first and foremost, one problem which lies deep in the conscience of the West, of the Muslim world, is the Palestinian issue. And I think that the new administration should get involved from the first year of this administration into finding a just and lasting settlement of the Palestinian and of the Arab-Israeli problem. And this is urgent because it's a long-standing problem. It is a problem that is affecting so many others, and it is really a cause of great concern in the whole Muslim world. So we do hope that the new administration will do this, and I hear from my talk to some advisors of the coming president that their intent to do so, because they understand how this is one of the core issues in the Middle East region and in the Muslim world in general. The other issues, of course, Iraq is a very important issue because the war in Iraq was always perceived as unjust, and I hope that sooner or later the coalition forces will withdraw. And I was happy to see that yesterday there was an agreement between the United States and the Iraqi government on finding a solution and certain timelines. By 2011, they have decided that the United States forces will withdraw from Iraq. Other issues, of course, are there. If Afghanistan, Kashmir, a lot of issues of great concern to the Muslim world. And I hope the United States can focus on those issues and bring about a just solution. I think also that we expect from a new administration to work more through multilateral approaches and not unilateral approaches, to work more through the United Nations, to see that the United Nations, that is the forum where all global issues are today discussed. And I think Mrs. Negroponte, who was with us at the United Nations many years ago, knows this. And her husband did a great job in representing the United States at the United Nations. And I think that we have to see that the United States also tries to abide by international law, because I think this has also, through the perception of the outside world, being a source that has affected the image of the United States, that the United States was not abiding by the international treaties, that Guantanamo was against international law, that non-respect of the Geneva Conventions was against international law, that the United States has so far, and I know this as an international lawyer, never joined the Law of the Sea Conventions, the International Criminal Court, the Kyoto Agreement, so many, even the Convention on the Protection of the Child. This has given the impression in the world that the United States doesn't care about international law. It only cares about its own policies and interests. And I think the next administration should try to change this perception. I think, finally, that the United States should also try to help the Muslim world in supporting democracy. This was an issue that was discussed today. But not to try to impose its own notion of democracy on the Muslim world. Democracy has to emerge from the societies according to their own pace and development. Yes, it has to be encouraged, but it cannot be imposed as an outside model. It will not work. And always, I think, you have to acknowledge and respect the cultural and religious heritage of these societies, and not to impose your own values on the Muslim societies. So this is extremely important in my view, again. Finally, let me say something about President-elect Obama. I think the fact that he was elected gave hope not only to the United States, but to the world, that there will be a change in policies, that there will be a change in style also, in the discourse used by the administration. To be honest with you, the Muslim world cannot overlook the fact that President Mubarak has some Muslim roots. Obama. has some Muslim roots, that his father was a Muslim, that he lived for a long time in Indonesia, a Muslim country. So there is a kind of sympathy, I think, among Muslims towards him. And of course that he has a Muslim name, Hussein, which is my name, by the way. So I think this is also a reason for people to hope for a better relationship with the next administration. We've seen during the campaign that sometimes this was used against him. And this was unfortunate, in my view. And according to some perception among Muslims, that he found himself obliged to distance himself from the fact that he related to the Muslims. But then he reasserted himself as saying, I am the president of all Americans, whoever they are. And I think we needed a courageous voice like the one of Colin Powell to say, Obama is a Christian. But what about if he was a Muslim? Don't Muslim Americans also have the right to become presidents of this country? Don't Muslim Americans also go and fight for the United States and die for our country? So this was, of course, a courageous stance by Colin Powell. Let me finally finish by saying that in spite of these problems, I believe there should be a number of initiatives and concrete steps undertaken to promote a better understanding, to repair what has been done by September 11. And there are many. The first one is, the most logical one, is to have more dialogue and contact, not only between governments, but between people. People-to-people contact is so important. Civil society, groups like yours, exchange of students, business relations between the United States and the Muslim world. And I'm happy to say that myself, I've been involved in organizing a big economic conference between the United States and the Arab world that took place in May of this year. And then there are many initiatives can be undertaken. For instance, initiatives on interfaith. And here I would point out to the initiative of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who called for a meeting at the United Nations last week that focused on interfaith, that focused on a dialogue between the three main religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and that focused on the common values we have together. And this was a way to stand up to the critical, to the extremists, the radicals all over the world, by saying we belong to different religions, but we have common values, and we have to work together, understand each other more. So this is, I think, was a very positive initiative. And then I think we have to focus on education. Education is the key for the Muslim world, for everyone, because education opens up the mind. Education makes people more tolerant towards each other. And I think the founder of Carnegie was the one, I think President Ellis mentioned it yesterday, who was calling for knowledge. The dissemination of knowledge is extremely important. So we have to focus. In the Arab world, education has become a priority, according to the latest meeting of the head of states of the Arab League. And they have consecrated the next decade focusing on education, improving it, reforming it, spending more money on it. And then there is culture. Culture is so important in this world. We all belong to a universal culture. And culture is a way of getting people closer together, understanding each other more. And again here, I am involved personally in an initiative. Together with the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, we are organizing the first Arab cultural and artistic festival in February of this year. I hope you will all come and attend. The 22 countries of the Arab League will be represented by the best artists in every way, in music, in dance, in costumes, in paintings, in literature. And for 3 weeks, you will have beautiful performances at the Kennedy Center. And what is the aim of that? It is to show another face of the Arab and the Muslim world, that we have a great culture, we have a great civilization. So to conclude, I just want to say that there are many challenges, I think, facing United States and Muslim relations, but many opportunities. And I think if we try to promote a better understanding, if we work together, we can succeed in overcoming the challenges, and certainly we'll have a better world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. If you would just join me here. And can you all hear me? Or
we have to, the mic.
Do we need
right
to use microphones?
Yeah, it's going to mic you up.
I think the first thing, there's so many things that we are all interested in. I'm going to ask a few questions of the ambassador, and then I'm going to open it up for all of you. There's so many things that we could talk about, but let me begin with the toughest, and that's the Israeli-Palestinian issue. You touched on it. So many American administrations, going back to a long time, but to the first president I covered, which was Jimmy Carter, have worked on this issue. And a little bit of progress has been made. And then there's been back, and then we've moved back, and there's been failure, disappointment, and then progress and failure. And what makes you believe? Well, let me be more specific. What exactly, practically, can this administration do that other administrations haven't already tried? And do you think the climate right now between Israel and the Palestinians is ripe, or maybe is it better a year from now? The timing. And what's needed?
Well, I must say I can claim to have some experience in that field. I was involved in the peace process for many, many years. I even went with President Sadat to Jerusalem in 1977. So I saw the beginning of peace emerging between the United States, between Israel and Egypt. And then when I was in the embassy in Washington as a political counselor, In the 70s, I was involved in the peace negotiations. I know it's tough, but I think that looking at to it from a historic perspective, we have achieved a lot. The difficulty we are facing now, that we are focusing on the core last issues in the conflict, which is mainly the Palestinian issue. I mean, there are always problems still between Israel and Syria and Lebanon, But the solution is not so difficult as settling the Palestinian issue. And the Palestinian issue is, of course, complex, but again, I think that there can be a solution because everyone knows what the solution should be. Even there was an Annapolis meeting a year ago, and there was an agreement to deal with all the issues. And since then, the two sides have been dealing with even some issues that at one point were considered by the Israelis as taboo, like Jerusalem or the refugee problem. They have talked about it because we know what the solution should be, a fair and balanced solution. So what do we expect from the next administration? We expect, as I said, for the administration to be involved from the beginning. In its first year, it has to be, when there's still a honeymoon between the American people and the rest of the world and the new president. And it has to be involved in a very active way. It has to also to be involved in a way we call as an honest broker. It should not be perceived as taking sides. We know that the ties between the United States and Israel, but in order to succeed, in order to be credible, it has to adopt a balanced and fair approach. And
you're saying that has not been there.
Well, to be honest, again, the Bush administration has disengaged itself at the beginning, maybe for fear of failure, or it found it was too difficult. So in the first year when it took over, it didn't get involved. And I can say the same about the Clinton administration. It only got involved in the very last year of its administration because it's such a difficult problem. But I think the next administration should get involved. It should play a balanced role. It should focus on finding fair solutions. And it shouldn't also be afraid of proclaiming and announcing what it sees as a fair solution. It is not to impose a settlement, but to help the parties to reach a compromise on these difficult issues. And I think this is not only my view. I attended the other day a very interesting meeting at the Aspen Institute where the former National Security Advisor of Carter, Brzezinski, and the former National Security Advisor, Scowcroft, took the same view, that it was about time for the United States to get involved forcefully and actively from the very beginning in trying to promote peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Does that mean?
There is a problem, of course. I don't think it can be done immediately for one reason, that we have to wait at least for the result of the Israeli election. We also have to wait for the Palestinians to overcome their internal problems between Fatah and Hamas. But I also think that if the Palestinian president representing Fatah can see some progress, show to his people that he can bring about a just peace. He can show to his people that the Palestinian prisoners will be released, for instance, that the settlement policy will be discontinued, and so on. Even the hardliners, I think, in the Palestinian movement will rally around him. This is my view.
Do you think that this is something that requires the very highest level involvement, the president himself, or could this be a specially appointed emissary? Does that really matter? Who?
I think for maybe, well, this depends on the president, but I think three people might be involved in that. A special envoy who might be sent to the region. He might even stay there in the region and shuttling, you know, between the two sides. The Secretary of State, of course, should get involved also, but eventually the president has to give full backing to this effort, because without a presidential involvement and strong support, I don't think it can be done. We've seen this in the past. I mean, peace between Egypt and Israel wouldn't have been achieved without President Carter being personally involved. And you said you were there at the time. And I've seen, I was negotiating with the Israelis in Blair House when I was political counselor of the embassy. And President Carter used to come and join us in the meetings with a pencil. So what's your view? What's your? This is a compromise I'm presenting you. So this is the way where we achieved results. And President Clinton, I think, did the same at Camp David when he tried to bring peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And then he presented his famous parameters of peace, which in my view still represent a good framework. And then we have the Arab Peace Initiative that sometimes is forgotten. This is a very important Arab initiative that was adopted at the summit meeting of the Arab League in Beirut 2002. It was reaffirmed again at the Riyadh summit meeting 2 years ago, and it contains the framework of a balanced settlement between the two, based on land for peace, that the Arabs are ready to recognize Israel, to grant it full security, to restore diplomatic relations with it, provided that the Israelis, on their part, withdraw to the 1967 borders, settle the Palestinian refugee problem, and accept a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. So it's a very balanced proposition. And lately we have heard, for instance, the president of Israel, Peres, from the United Nations last week, he said that the Arab Peace Initiative is an interesting document, but we need more than just saying it's interesting. We need to have it implemented and respected.
Do you have any, last question on this, do you have any early inkling or hint of how much of a priority this will be for President-elect Obama, or is it just too early to say?
From what I have heard is that the administration looks at this problem not only because it might bring a solution to the Arab-Israeli problem, but that it could also affect the image of the United States in the Arab and the Muslim world, that it could improve relations in general with the Arab and the Muslim world. And that because of the interrelationship of problems, economic and political and so, this is crucial. So I think he will focus on this. It doesn't mean that he will, of course, not focus on the top priority, which is the financial crisis and the economic situation. But at the same time, I don't think he can neglect this problem if we can have a better relationship between the United States and the Muslim world.
One of the things, Mr. Ambassador, that gets a lot of attention in this country is, what is happening with the extremist groups around the world and the recruitment of young, I guess mostly men, but men and women to these groups. How concerned are you that with the economic downturn here and globally, that is a problem that's going to grow worse? Will it stay the same? Do you see the Obama administration having any effect on that? How do you see that?
Well, it is a worrying problem, I think, for our societies. There's no doubt about it. And that is why I was saying that maybe the next administration should get more involved in trying to help Muslim societies in overcoming their problem. The problem, what is the breeding ground for these young terrorists? It's poverty, it's illiteracy, it's despair, it's not settling the big crisis which they're confronting. Also the lack of democracy. So these are the reasons. So I think we have to address these issues, and I think the next administration can do this by helping more those countries, by helping them in education and in reforms in general. But I think it remains a problem. But for instance, I believe that if the Palestinian issue finds a solution, if the Iraqi problem comes to an end, this is already a big, big step towards depriving those who want to recruit the young people from a very important ground. I mean, they're exploiting all that. Because of these problems, they're recruiting people, and these people, many of them, are ignorant people, they're desperate people, they're unemployed, they're poor. So it's very easy to recruit them. So let's focus on finding solutions, and let's focus on helping those societies to rebuild themselves and to prosper.
Okay, before we open it up for the to the audience for questions, I have one last question, and that is a lot of speculation, discussion about how serious the president-elect is about naming Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. And we don't know whether this will happen. We read, I think, from reliable news sources that they are seriously vetting the finances and the business dealings of former President Clinton. But my question to you is, how would the Arab world, how would the Muslim world look upon a Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton?
Well, let me tell you first, I was asked the other day, you know, I'm a professional diplomat. So I grew up as a young diplomat till I became ambassador and assistant minister and now representing the Arab League. And someone told me, do you think it's better at the head of the State Department to have a professional diplomat or a politician? And I tell you what I think personally. I might be wrong. I think for most countries, it's better to have a professional diplomat because they understand more the issue, without offense to anyone in this room. They understand more the issues. They grew up. They know the people, the challenges facing the diplomats. They can improve the conditions of the diplomat. They can train them better and so on. But for the United States, I think you need a political figure. Because the United States is a leading country in the world. And in order to deal with the rest of the world, with all these difficult problems, I think you need a personality of high profile. So whatever this is, if it's Hillary Clinton or Sarah Palin or who else, I think it would be a good thing. And it would be accepted, I mean, whoever the United States decides to appoint will be accepted by the rest of the world. But I think we will look more to the kind of policies adopted than the people who implement those policies.
Answered like a diplomat. Well, Mr. Ambassador, thank you very much for your presentation and for speaking, I think, from not only your head but from your heart about these issues that matter so much to all of us, especially as we embark on a new administration and what may be a new policy direction. We'll see. Thank you very much.
This has been a production of the Women's Foreign Policy Group with funding from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For more information about this and other Women's Foreign Policy Group events, please visit www.wfpg.org.